And joining us now on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts, Professor Noam Chomsky, activist, author, and Professor Emeritus of Linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Professor Chomsky, it's good of you to come on TVO tonight. How are you?
Glad to be with you.
Let's talk some Middle East peace, sir. As you know, the Obama administration has put the renewed push for a two-state solution on the agenda. That's their best solution, they believe, to the Israeli-Palestinian standoff, and I'd like to know how on side you are with the president's efforts.
Well, first of all, I don't really agree with the premise. If he was interested in pushing for a two-state solution, meaning a sensible version of that, he would be following different tactics. So the first of all, would require a change in a long-standing U.S. policy going back 35 years of blocking the overwhelming international consensus on a two-state settlement, and Obama is continuing with that. His policies are a continuation of the rejectionist policies of the past, and it's worth bearing in mind. In fact, you can see this in even the framework of the negotiations is kind of a charade.
Well, if you don't think he's interested in a two-state solution, what do you think he's interested in?
I think he's interested in protecting his political base and supporting the core U.S. power institutions, which are quite happy with U.S. support for Israeli expansion, criminal actions, and so on.
Well, if that were the case, his popularity among the Jewish community in the United States has sunk like a stone. He has no support in Israel at all. Certainly, you know, pro-Israeli commentators are furious with him because he's, at least I thought he was pretty adamant about a settlement freeze before any negotiations could get much further. So some people think he's too tough on Israel.
Well, first of all, it's not quite true about the American Jewish community, which is separating and increasingly is opposed to U.S. policy and hence drifting away. In Israel, it's what you say is correct, but that's a comment about Israel. Israel has been moving in the last few years very sharply to the ultra-nationalist right, and nothing is good enough for them unless it gives away everything. But it takes, say, the settlement freeze, which you mentioned. The settlement freeze is a minor footnote. The fact that that's put in front and center tells you right away that the negotiations aren't serious. I mean, the issue is the settlements, not the settlement freeze. When Obama weakly says he opposes a settlement freeze, a settlement expansion, he's simply repeating George Bush's position. In fact, he's repeating the what's called the roadmap, you know, supposedly the basis that for a settlement, which says quite explicitly that in the first stage there must be no further growth of settlements, including natural growth. Hmm. Now, one of his predecessors, George Bush number one, actually put a little, not much, but a little force behind his opposition to settlement freeze. He said that he, in fact, implemented a penalty, withdrawal of loan guarantees if the settlement expansion continued too blatantly. They didn't pay much attention if it considered continued quietly. Obama was asked about this when his first speech came out about settlement freeze, repeating Bush's position, and he said no. His spokesperson said, no, this, we're not going to do anything like that. Our opposition to a settlement freeze is purely symbolic. That's telling Netanyahu, do whatever you like. And the settlement freeze altogether is a minor issue. By now, let's suppose there's no more expansion of borders. Actually, Obama's offered more expansion, but suppose there is no more. Israel already has taken over more than 40% of the West Bank with U.S. support, strong U.S. support. It has violated the Oslo agreements by separating Gaza from the West Bank. Gaza is under a shameful, murderous siege. All of that's being continued.
Let me pursue just how strong or weak you think the United States can or ought to be in the region. And to do that, I want to read a quote to you from Seymour Reich, who's the former chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, who said the following quite recently in a letter to the Washington Post. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu seems intent on wringing as many concessions and inducements from the Obama administration as possible. That the United States has to resort to such extraordinary enticements just to get Israel to agree to a 90-day settlement freeze reinforces the perception, especially in the Middle East, of a weakened United States. So follow up on that, if you would. How powerful or not do you think the American government is in getting things done in the Middle East?
Well, getting things done with Iran, it has its problems because, contrary to much commentary, the United States is quite isolated in the world on its Iran policies, including in the Middle East. But with regard to Israel, it can basically get what it wants. Israel made a fateful decision back in 1971, it's never departed from it, to prefer expansion to security. In 1971, Egypt offered a full peace treaty to Israel, which would have meant complete security. Jordan did the same a year later. But Israel wanted to expand at that time, mostly into the northeast Sinai, Egyptian Sinai. So it rejected the offer.
It would have said for security reasons, though, wouldn't it?
No, it wasn't for security reasons. Security would have meant accepting the Egyptian offer, which they finally were compelled to do in 1978 after a dangerous war. If Egypt is out of the game, Israel has security, particularly if Jordan goes along. The issue was expansion, straight and simple. They were, at that time, planning driving Bedouins, farmers, out of the northeast Sinai, Egyptian Sinai, planning to establish a major city, Yamit, 1 million people in Egyptian territory and a lot of settlements. And they were starting the expansion into the West Bank. Well, those are not for security reasons. And that remains true today. They could have security now if they agreed to a diplomatic settlement that's advocated by essentially the entire world, certainly every relevant actor.
Let me follow up on that then for a second. You used the word serious earlier in one of your earlier answers. You said if the Obama administration were serious, it would be doing something else. Okay, tell us, what if it were serious, what would it be telling the Israelis to do?
It would expand on what George Bush number one did. It would simply say that U.S. Military, economic, and diplomatic support for the occupation will end, and will end until the IDF, the Israeli army, pulls out of the West Bank.
And how would that manifest itself?
How would it? Just the way I said, by implementing that. Majority of the American population is already in favor of it, and a good part of the Jewish population, incidentally. Now, of course, it's not quite that simple, so you have to have negotiations to settle the exact nature of the withdrawal and the two-state settlement. It's come close. We sort of know what that would look like. A solution of that kind came quite close in January 2001. Now, that happens to be the one time in the last 35 years when an American president, this was Clinton in his last month, was willing to at least tolerate a diplomatic settlement. The two sides negotiated within the framework of what were called Clinton's parameters. And they came very close to a settlement. In fact, in their last press conference, they said with a few more days they might settle everything.
But I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying, though. Are you saying that if the Americans were serious about talking tough to Israel, they would no longer sell them military equipment, no longer give them the annual subsidy they give the government of Israel? What else?
Or the diplomatic support, which Obama has pledged to continue, namely vetoing Security Council resolutions and so on, not for Israel itself, that's a separate matter, but for the occupation. In fact, military aid to Israel that's used in the occupation is not only in violation of international law, as Amnesty International has pointed out, but it's also in violation of U.S. law, which permits military aid only for the purposes of defense.
Then tell us this, why would that not, if the American government were to do that, why would that not embolden those who are anxious to see Israel wiped off the map?
Like who, for example?
Well, start with Hamas, Hezbollah, go on from there.
No, Hamas has called for a two-state settlement. In fact, repeatedly. I mean, look, I don't like Hamas. In fact, I dislike them a lot. And there's a lot you can criticize in their positions, but we might as well be fair about it. They have repeatedly said that they would accept a two-state settlement, not as a permanent settlement, but that's really not at issue. I mean, take, say, Mexico. Mexico recognizes the United States. It doesn't accept the legitimacy of the fact that the United States conquered half of Mexico.
Okay, but Mexicans aren't sending suicide bombers over the border to try to blow up, you know, American installations. That has happened and would happen.
And the United States is not occupying Mexico and carrying out violent repression there and illegal takeover of further Mexican lands.
So do you
in fact, suicide bombers aren't there anymore.
Do you see this then as a dispute between two essentially equally egregious partners?
I think we describe it in terms of the wrong conflict. It's a conflict between, on one side, the United States and Israel, and on the other side, the world, literally almost without exception. So, for example, it's Europe, theoretically Canada, though I don't know what Canada's position is now under
Harper. I should tell you, Canada is the most pro-Israeli government probably in the Western world right now, so it's not
exactly... Well, I don't know if Canada has withdrawn its former support for the international consensus. I haven't seen that. But it includes Europe, the non-aligned countries, the League of Arab States, the Organization of Islamic States, which includes Iran. No relevant actors opposed other than the U.S. and Israel. If there were serious negotiations going on now, they would be U.S. and Israel on one side and the world on the other side with some neutral element running them. Or it would be like the Taba negotiations in January 2001, where the U.S. stepped back, and though it approved of them, as you remember, Clinton's last month, and the two sides did come pretty close to an agreement.
Okay, let's try this, Professor Chomsky. I guess most of the conventional wisdom suggests that there's a two-state solution on the table. It's just how you get there is the problem, but they know what the bottom line is. It's just a matter of getting there. There's more talk these
days
about...
You won't get there as long as the U.S. opposes it.
Okay, understood. But let's talk about something that seems to be gaining certainly much discussion. I don't know about how much currency, but much discussion. And that's a one-state solution. Palestinian Arabs, Israeli Jews, all coexisting in one state, one person, one vote. What's your view on that?
Yeah. Well, I think there's an even better solution, which is just as realistic. A no-state solution, which would be a regional settlement in which borders would be eroded. There's no inherent justification for recognizing the imperial opposed borders. I mean, just to tell you a personal experience, my wife and I were hitchhiking back in 1953 along the Israeli-Lebanese border from the Israeli side. And by accident, we just crossed the border. There's no particular reason to break the border there except imperial power. And finally a jeep came by and yelled at us to tell us get back. And we were in Lebanon, you know, so okay, we crossed over. But that's the way it ought to be. And that's just as realistic as a one-state settlement. Now, in fact, I'm in favor of a one-state settlement, always have been since the 1940s. Actually, it's not one state, it's a binational state because there are definitely two communities, two cultures, two languages, two traditions, and so on. But a binational state would make good sense. And I would be in favor of advocacy of that. There's no point to proposing it. I mean, we can propose that people should live in peace, and maybe that makes us feel good. But it's not true advocacy unless you sketch out a path from here to there. Now, I think there is a path from here to there, but it's in stages. And the first stage would be a two-state settlement, which could lead to reduction of the cycle of violence, to a recognition on the part of both groups over time that a border anywhere in the mandatory Palestine just makes no sense at all. Commercial relations, sports relations, cultural relations could increase, and you could move towards some federal arrangement or even closer integration. If there's another proposal, form of advocacy, I've never heard it.
Well, talk to me about this thing.
Seems to me is empty.
Try this one. You'll be better on the history than I will. Let's grant that. But my recollection is back in the late 1940s, the United Nations came together. They voted in favor of the creation of a homeland for the Jews in what was formerly mandatory Palestine, because they had decided in their wisdom that the Jewish people had suffered enough during World War II and they needed a homeland. How would your one-state solution deal with what the world apparently at the time decided was the urgency to create a homeland for Jews somewhere in the world?
Well, first of all, the world didn't decide that. There was a majority in the General Assembly, largely because of extensive U.S. pressure. But it's a majority for a recommendation, and you omitted the fact that it included a Palestinian state. Plus, the same recommendation recognized that the indigenous population had some rights too, in fact, limited rights. So they gave they gave 55% of the territory to the Jewish state, even though Jews owned about 7% of the land. The indigenous population got much less, but it proposed two states. Then go through the history, but at the time I was a Zionist youth activist opposed to a Jewish state, because that was a significant part of the Zionist movement at the time. And I'm still opposed to it for the same reason. Once the state is established, okay, then it has the same rights as any state in the international system, almost all of them established by violence, not least yours and mine. But sure, it has the same rights as others, but no more rights. That changed in 1967 when Israel conquered the currently occupied territories and recognized instantly, within months, literally, that any expansion into the occupied territories was a severe violation of international law. The government was advised by its chief legal advisor, Theodore Meron, a very distinguished international legal figure. The Attorney General went along with it. Moshe Dayan, who was in charge of the occupied territories, he agreed too. He said, yeah, sure, it's in violation of international law, but states violate international law.
But I just want to make sure I'm clear on your original assertion, which is, is it true that you do not believe there is a need for a Jewish state in this world?
I don't believe there's a need for any state in this world. I think they're all illegitimate, but they exist, okay? And as I said, for the Levant, the region, Palestine, Lebanon, Jordan, and so on, my view is that a better solution would be to erode the borders. In fact, I think that's a good solution for much of the world, let's say Europe, which is slowly moving in that direction after centuries of savagery and destruction. That's a long-term objective. States are not inherently legitimate. The nation state is a European invention expanded over the rest of the world. And even in Europe, they're eroding. But if you talk about this situation, it's appropriate to have a Jewish self-determination in some region. Now, that can be part of a multinational state.
Okay.
In fact, from 67 to 75, in those years, actually, I was writing about that and advocating it, because it was feasible then. In fact, turns out Israeli military intelligence was suggesting something more or less similar, not quite that.
Okay, Professor Chomsky, forgive me, let me jump in because we're about 5-6 minutes to go, and I'm definitely interested in your views on the current movement around the world calling for boycott, divestment, and sanctions of Israel, the so-called BDS movement. What's your view on that?
You can't have a view on that, pro or con. Everyone should understand that that's a tactic, not a principle. Tactics have to be evaluated in terms of their consequences. I was involved in BDS before the movement ever crystallized, but you have to pick the measures in such a way that they'll be conducive to your ends, not harmful to your ends. So to take another example, during the Vietnam War, the Vietnamese were They're pretty firm about what tactics they approved of and which ones they opposed. For example, they opposed weatherman tactics, you know, breaking windows and so on, however dedicated the people were, because they realized that's going to just create support for the war, and they had a lot at stake. What they were in favor of, as they said, was women standing in silence at graves of soldiers. They thought that was a good tactic. Well, tactics have to be evaluated.
Okay, there, how about these BDS tactics against Israel? How would you evaluate those?
Depends which ones you mean.
Well,
All
right, let me give you an example.
Some of them are fine. Yeah.
Let me give an example. In 2007, university and college union in Britain voted in favor of an academic boycott of Israeli universities, and since then there have been other institutions. I know, for example, the Canadian Union of Public Employees in Canada discussed having a boycott of Israel as well. Calls for universities to divest from corporations that do business in Israel. Do you think these kinds of boycotts can have a positive impact on changing Israeli policy?
Depends how they're formulated. An academic boycott, in fact, I was opposed to academic boycotts in South Africa too. And in fact, though some of them made sense, like the ones opposed to racist hire, boycotting for racist hiring practices, that made sense, it was understandable. But if a blanket boycott on, say, Tel Aviv University immediately raises the question, which hardliners will be very happy to seize upon, why not boycott Harvard? They're involved in much more serious crimes than Tel Aviv University is. You don't want to expose yourself to legitimate charges of hypocrisy. That just undermines what you're doing. On the other hand, part of what you said I do approve of. So boycott and divestment from firms that are carrying out operations in the occupied territories, that makes good sense. Just like an ending on arms shipments makes good sense. And that can be understood by the population. But those are the kinds of things you have to think about if you mean to have tactics that are going to be effective. I mean, whatever, it's just standard in activism. There's two kinds of tactics, roughly. There's the kind to make you feel good, and the kind that do good. And they're not necessarily identical, as the Vietnamese example illustrated. So it might have made weathermen feel good to break windows, but the Vietnamese understood that it was harmful. And the same's been true here. There are effective uses of the BDS tactic, which have worked quite well, and also have the effect of educating people as to what's going on. There are other kinds which are harmful. You have to pick and choose when you talk about tactics.
Okay, you're making an important distinction between disinvestment from businesses that do business in the territories and, involvement in post-secondary institutions. There are some of your, I guess I would call them, former colleagues or former allies who are disappointed that you are not in favor of a sort of more all-encompassing, broad-brush BDS approach. Do you feel odd to be disenfranchised from them at this point in your life?
In the late 1960s, there were activists I was very much involved in resistance, faced a long jail sentence and so on. But there were young people who were disappointed that I didn't favor the tactic of going out in the streets and breaking windows. And I didn't, because it was harmful, just as the Vietnamese said. So you have to pick and choose, always. That's the nature of tactics. So for example, if you want to disinvest from Israel entirely, why not give up your computer if it has Intel chips in it? Because Intel's involved in crimes all over the world, including Israel, where Intel is establishing its major next generation chip factory. So if you're serious about it, throw out your computer.
In our last minute here, I want to ask you one more thing. People have followed your life and your activism for a very long time. They may not know. I think you're 81 now. Is that right?
82 in a couple of days.
82 in a couple of days. I wonder, does the fire still burn as strongly at your stage of the game?
Easily, maybe more so, as the problems become more severe.
Noam Chomsky, it's awfully good of you to spend some time with us here on TVO tonight. Thank you very much.
Good to be with you.